Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, Ana Mateo brings us Words and Their Stories, a program that explores common expressions in American English and discusses their meaning and history. Later, Steve Ember brings us Making of a Nation, an ongoing series about America's history. But first, the Higher Education Report.
There are many reasons why college and university students often fail to get full nights of sleep. Many American students are away from their parents for the first time when they attend college. They might not be used to having total freedom in how they plan their days and nights. Parties, late-night study meetings, or just time spent relaxing with friends, these are all things that cut into college students' sleep habits. A few years ago, Michael Scullin began teaching the science of sleep to psychology students at Baylor University in Waco, Texas. Scullin is an assistant professor at Baylor and the director of its Sleep, Neuroscience, and Cognition Laboratory. The class centered around why the body needs to sleep and the physical and mental health problems caused by a lack of sleep. This includes difficulty focusing on studies or controlling one's emotions and increased risk of many diseases. When you are at your most sleep-deprived is when you are least likely to be able to judge how sleepy you are and how much that sleepiness is impacting you, Scullin told VOA.
He says his students seemed to enjoy the class and were interested in the material he was teaching. But when he asked them whether they were choosing to get more sleep after what they had learned, most of them said no. The United States Center for Disease Control and Prevention states that adults need at least 7 hours of sleep a night to stay healthy. So Scullin came up with a plan to get his students to sleep more. He offered to give them extra points on their final exam, the class's most important test. The plan worked better than Scullin expected. Students who slept more performed better in two different classes, and Scullin published his findings in two academic publications last November. Scullin started the experiment with his psychology students. He told them that if they agreed to sleep at least 8 hours a night for the last 5 nights before the final exam, they would get several extra credit points. But if they agreed to take part in the study and failed to get the required amount of sleep, they would lose points on the exam. The students would wear special devices that recorded their sleep data. Only 8 out of the 18 total students in that first group agreed to take part in the experiment. Yet all the students who took part performed better on the exam than those who did not, even before the extra credit points were added. On average, they earned about 5 points more on the exam. Scullin then decided to repeat the study with another group of 16 design students. He chose not to punish students who failed to sleep the full 8 hours per night and got the same results.
Daniel Bessison is a medical doctor who researches sleep and was not involved in the study. He is also the associate director of the Anschutz Health and Wellness Center at the University of Colorado outside Denver. Bessison notes this study does lend support to the idea that sleeping enough helps academic performance, and students who cram are likely worse off. Cramming is a common activity for American college students. When students cram, they study most or all of the night before the exam. They get very little or no sleep because they think they will do better if the test material is fresh in their minds. Bessison says there are some problems with Scullin's experiment. He says to be more scientific, the students should have been randomly chosen for sleeping or staying awake. Also, the two groups should have been studying the same subject and taking the same test. All of this may have affected the results of the study. Yet, Bessison says this experiment does fit in with a larger body of research on the importance of sleep. In fact, the amount of sleep people get has been decreasing greatly, he says. A 2015 study found the number of Americans who sleep less than 6 hours a night increased by about 30 million between 1985 and 2012. Scullin and Bessison offer some ways to avoid health problems caused by a lack of sleep. Among these, they say, parents should try to get enough sleep themselves to demonstrate its importance to their children. Bessison notes that even some medical school programs have begun to require student doctors to sleep more to prevent accidents.
Scullin also offers a few pieces of advice to his students who have difficulty falling asleep. They include the following. Avoid looking at electronics before you are about to fall asleep. Do not drink anything with caffeine in it, such as coffee or tea, less than 6 hours before you go to sleep. Try to go to sleep at the same time every night. If you are lying in bed trying to sleep and cannot calm your mind, get out of bed. Take out a piece of paper and spend 5 to 10 minutes writing down all of your thoughts. If you wake up in the middle of the night and cannot fall back asleep, get out of bed and go into another room. Do not turn on the lights. Instead, wait there until you start to feel tired again. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.
Now, the VOA Learning English Program, Words and Their Stories. For today's program, we go into the kitchen. There is a good chance you do not go one day without using a knife. It is an important tool when cooking, and without it, you could not make many dishes. This brings to mind a story, a true story. Years ago, a friend and I were making dinner together at my place. She had the job of cutting up vegetables for soup. Halfway through cutting the onions, she said that my knife was not sharp and would not cut. I was surprised. I had given her my best knife. But when I looked over at her, I had to smile. Actually, I did more than smile. I laughed out loud. It might be better if you use the cutting edge of the knife, I joked. Let's just say my friend did not spend a lot of time in the kitchen. She ate out a lot. In this example, the cutting edge is the sharp edge of a knife. But we also use it to mean something much more. The cutting edge is the newest and most modern part of any industry. Ideas, tools, technology, whatever you use in your job can all be cutting edge. Whatever business or industry you work in, it feels good to be a leader in it. When you know the newest tools or ideas to do your job, you can say you are on the cutting edge, or that you are simply cutting edge. For example, teachers on the cutting edge of education use the latest technology and ideas in the classroom. Cutting edge architects know the latest materials, tools, and designs to use in the structures they build. Some of the best doctors use cutting edge technology to treat diseases. All industries have their own cutting edge. We have other words to help describe this idea of cutting edge. For example, people who are on the cutting edge of their industry are on the forefront or front line. They are the vanguard. The vanguard is the group of people who are the leaders of a movement in society, politics, or in a given industry. We usually use vanguard in the singular form and in a prepositional phrase. So you can be at the vanguard of a social or political movement. You can also be in the vanguard of a movement. This expression comes from a military term. In battle, the vanguard are the soldiers, other personnel or equipment that are at the front of a fighting force. People on the cutting edge or in the vanguard are blazing a trail. When you blaze a trail in the woods, you make a trail for others to follow. You do this by cutting down plants that may be in your way. You can also mark trees with a cut, also called a blaze. Blazing a trail is a difficult job, but it makes it much easier for people walking behind you. The same can be said for life. Trailblazers, people on the cutting edge or in the vanguard, are not satisfied with the status quo, the way things have always been done. They are always looking for a new, better, or faster way to do something. So people on the cutting edge use the latest tools and ideas to be on the forefront of their field. They are the vanguard and blaze trails for others to follow. We could say that people who use our website are on the cutting edge of learning English. Well, until science makes a magical solution that gives you language ability overnight. Now that would be very cutting edge. And that's all for this Words and Their Stories. Until next time, I'm Anna Mateo.
And I saw a panther in the yard, moving slow across the ledge with silver eyes and a cool regard and hunger with a cutting edge.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, I'm Steve Ember. The Mexican-American War officially ended in 1848. Mexico agreed to give California and New Mexico to the United States. And Mexico would recognize the Rio Grande River as the southern border of Texas. Thus, President James K. Polk had succeeded in expanding the United States. He had added Oregon, California, Texas, and New Mexico to the country. Now the country faced the problem of what to do with slavery in the new territories.
As soon as it became clear in the American consciousness that Polk's aim in the Mexican War was to gain southwestern territory, California and what's now the American Southwest, then the slavery question becomes very, very salient in a powerful way that it had been kind of sort of kept under wraps for 20, 25 years.
Robert Merry is an historian and the author of a book about James K. Polk.
So we went through 10 years of kind of political hell in America as we struggled with that issue, which could only be settled through force of arms.
Southerners argued that they had the right to bring slaves into California and New Mexico. Northerners opposed any further spread of slavery, but the real question was a legal one. Did Congress have the power to control or ban slavery in the territories? While Congress debated the issue, the country moved quickly into the presidential campaign of 1848. President Polk was old, tired, and in poor health. He said he would keep his promise to serve only one term. Polk felt that he had done his duty. During the first days of his administration, he listed the goals of his presidency. First, he wanted to reduce the tax on imports. Second, he wished to establish an independent treasury, which the Whigs had voted out. Third, he hoped to settle the Oregon border dispute with Britain. And fourth, he wanted to make California part of the United States. Less than 4 years later, he had succeeded with each item on his list. The United States and Britain agreed on a compromise in the Oregon dispute. In 1846, Polk was able to establish the independent treasury again, where the government could keep its own funds. No longer would government money be kept in private banks. That same year, Polk was able to get Congress to approve a bill that greatly reduced the taxes on imports. And the peace treaty with Mexico gave the United States not only California, but also New Mexico. So the president believed he had served his country well. Polk, however, had not served his party well. He was not a good politician. He failed to unite competing groups within the Democratic Party. What was worse, he let them move even farther apart. There seemed to be no strong Democratic candidate who could unite the party. At one extreme were the supporters of former President Martin Van Buren, New York Democrats opposed to slavery. They were called barn burners. They got this name from their opponents, who claimed that they were willing to burn down the entire barn to remove pro-slavery rants. At the party's other extreme were the Democrats of the South, led by John C. Calhoun of South Carolina. In every state, the Democrats were divided between those who supported the Polk administration and those who opposed it. Democratic candidates met in Baltimore in May of 1848 to choose their candidate for president. On the fourth vote, the delegates chose Senator Lewis Cass of Michigan as the party's presidential candidate. Cass was 66 years old. He was considered a moderate Democrat. He was a Northerner who did not oppose slavery. On the question of slavery in the new territories, Cass believed that the people living in those areas should make the decision. The barn burner Democrats of New York refused to accept Cass as their candidate. They walked out of the Baltimore Convention. Senator Henry Clay of Kentucky expected to be the presidential candidate of the Whig Party. The Whigs had nominated Clay as their candidate in three earlier elections, but Clay lost all three times. In 1848, older members of the party still supported him, but young Whigs felt a new candidate was needed. Some party leaders remembered how William Henry Harrison had won the presidency for the Whigs in 1840 by campaigning as a military hero. The country now had a new military hero, Old Zach, General Zachary Taylor. He and his men never lost a battle in the Mexican War. Several times, General Taylor defeated Mexican forces much larger than his. Taylor was 63 years old. He had almost no formal education. He had spent almost 40 years in the West as an Indian fighter and commander of small army bases. Some politicians did not believe Taylor had the ability to be president, but his supporters put great energy into their campaign. They tried to sell the idea that the general was the only man who could defeat the candidate of the Democratic Party. Finally, Taylor won the Whig Party's nomination. Many Americans did not like either presidential candidate because of the candidate's policies on slavery. Lewis Cass saw nothing wrong with slavery if that was what the people wanted, and Zachary Taylor was a slave owner. So a group of men in Ohio decided to form a new political party. They called it the Free Soil Party, because they believed in free land for free settlers. They wanted no further spread of slavery. The Free Soil leaders proposed a convention of all who supported their ideas. 10,000 people went to the convention in Buffalo, New York. For 2 days, the delegates debated the slavery issue and discussed their choice of a candidate for president. They also worked on a platform, a statement of their party's purpose. The platform declared that slavery was an institution of the states, not the nation. It said Congress had no right to help spread slavery by permitting it in the new Western territories. The platform declared that the issue should be faced with firmness. No more slave states. No more slave territory. No more compromises with slavery anywhere. Convention delegates then voted on candidates. They chose former President Martin Van Buren as the party's candidate. The people of the nation voted on November 7, 1848. It was the first time a presidential election was held on the same day in all parts of the country. Zachary Taylor won both the popular and electoral votes. He became the 12th President of the United States. Congress met a few weeks after the election, long before Taylor took office. It faced serious problems. Territorial governments were needed for the areas won in the war against Mexico. California especially needed help. Gold had been discovered in California. Thousands of people were moving there. A government was needed to protect the lives and property of the new population. Then there was the question of laws forcing northern states to return escaped slaves to their owners. The laws were not always obeyed. Southerners wanted a new law that would be easier to enforce. Congress found it difficult to act on these problems. The House of Representatives was controlled by members of the Free Soil Party, which opposed slavery. The Senate was controlled by Southerners who supported slavery. The two sides found it almost impossible to agree on anything. Early in January 1849, a congressman proposed a bill to first limit and then end slavery in the District of Columbia. Opposition to the bill was strong. It was amended. The new bill would simply close all places in the District of Columbia where slaves were bought and sold. Southern congressmen disliked the bill, even as amended. They organized a committee representing every one of the southern states. Senator John C. Calhoun said the committee should write a declaration explaining the position of the South. The committee agreed, and Calhoun wrote most of the declaration himself. The Southern Declaration accused the North of many aggressions. The South, it said, faced many dangers. Soon there would be enough free states to control both the House and the Senate. And then the Constitution would be changed and all slaves would be freed. And this, said the Southern Declaration, would lead to bitter hostility and war between North and South. The Declaration called on the people of the South to unite and be firm in their opposition to the North. With this new firmness, Southern lawmakers fought to make slavery legal in the new territories. They effectively blocked proposals for territorial governments in California and New Mexico. Congress ended its term on March 4, 1849, without any progress. Zachary Taylor was sworn in as president that same day. Americans hoped that the new president would be able to bring the North and South together again. But Taylor really had no policy. He could not support a bill to keep slavery out of the territories. That might start a quick revolt among the southern states. He could not support a bill to let slavery spread into the territories. That would make the North rise in anger. Taylor tried to be neutral. He hoped the problem of slavery would solve itself.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.
This